Music from Twilight Paris. Keeping my eyes on you. 14 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning here along the Broken Road, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and a vigneron down in Garden Valley, Texas, and joins us just about every Tuesday morning. We talk about creation and evolution and faith and science and such things, and we learn a lot from Dr. Don. Don, good morning. How you doing? How's life down in the Lone Star State today?
I'm doing well, thank you. And yes, life down here is beginning. It's all beginning. Our vines are now sprouting, which means a lot of activity in the vineyard.
Okay.
And just a lot of activity overall.
So and so the fight picks up against all those predatory people and animals that like grapes, right? You got to be out there defending the vineyard.
Well, yes, in the first line of defense is against fungal infections, because this time of the year is usually wet and it starts to get muggy, and that's a perfect environment for fungus, and they love the tender shoots.
Yeah, okay. Well, take care of it. We want to make sure that vineyard prospers down there, because the Texas wine industry depends on you, Don.
If they depended on me, we'd be in bad shape.
Yeah. Now, David,
it's good to know that spring is coming somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere. That's nice.
Good.
That's a positive
good to hear.
Thought. Yeah. Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah. Listen, today's a special day, and David, we need to sing happy birthday.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Happy birthday to you.
To you.
Happy birthday,
happy
to,
birthday
you.
To you.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, dear.
DNA. See if I can deoxyribonucleic acid. How close was I, Don? Was that pretty good?
Oh, very good, actually.
Yeah, all right.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it was discovered, at least reported as having been discovered, on this day in 1953 by two Cambridge University scientists, James Watson. Watson, I need you. Now, that was Bell Telephone. That was Alexander Graham. That was a different deal. Francis Crick was also on the experiment, and they determined the double helix structure of DNA. And the article here I'm looking at talks about DNA. I know I've often wondered what DNA was, but it's a molecule, right? It's
a polymer. It's what's called a macromolecule.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unique because it is a double strand. I mean, there's two long molecules, for example, wrapped around each other,
mm-hmm.
and that's what makes up the DNA. Well,
they would have discovered this then under a microscope. Is that right?
Well, X-ray diffraction, actually.
Okay.
You have to use because you're looking at the molecular structure of the molecule, and so mm-hmm. Actually two groups were involved with this, and the article doesn't go into the second group very much, but one was out in California, Linus Pauling, the famous
vitamin C guy.
Who promoted vitamin C and taking, gram quantities of vitamin C for your health. He was, his lab was working on it.
Was Linus Pauling ever right about anything?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, okay. he was. Mm-hmm. I mean, and vitamin C obviously is good for you,
okay.
and it's one of the vitamins that can't really hurt you. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you can take a ton of it, and it's not gonna hurt you, and it's a great antioxidant for water-soluble free radicals.
Oh.
That's a different story.
I'm glad to know.
But the topic for the day is DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's... competition kind of developed between the two groups. Of course, James Watson and Francis Crick were in England, and as I said, Linus Pauling and his group was out in California, and they were both trying to do the same, determine the structure. That wasn't, the DNA was known, but it was known that there's something inside the cell that can carries this genetic information. Other biologists and scientists had thought about and said there must be something in there, and so this long fibrous type of material was isolated from the cells and then crystallized, And then X-ray diffraction were taken of it. And then they had to, in order to decipher an X-ray diffraction pattern, you have to assume some structure for your molecule. So if you're dealing with the small molecule, you know, you have a limited amount of trial and error that you need to do in order to then go back and calculate what the X-ray pattern might be, for example. But when you're dealing with a large molecule, in this case, a doubly stranded molecule, then both Linus Pauling and Watson and Crick understood that it had to be a double-stranded structure from the X-ray pattern. But Linus Pauling was working kind of from the backbone out. The backbone of this structure is a phosphate sugar backbone. That means it's got a sugar molecule, the ribose in this case, and deoxy just means that it's missing one of the hydroxyl groups that would normally be on ribose. So ribose is a 5-carbon sugar, and then attached to two of the alcohol groups on the ribose is phosphate, and it's the phosphate that joins two, let's say, two sugars together. And so you repeat that pattern up and down the chain, and that makes your the backbone of your DNA. Well, DNA is also composed of nucleic acids, those are attached again through the hydroxyl group to the ribose, and so the ribose is kind of acting like, well, you know, it's holding things together, and the phosphates are in between. And then the nucleic acids are what contain the different information, which ultimately codes for proteins in a you know, in our bodies. Well, Linus Pauling and his group were working from the backbone is up against each other, and nucleic acids are sticking out. And they tried different configurations, and it didn't seem that it was working quite well. And then Watson and Crick got the idea that, hey, why don't we just turn this thing around so that the nucleic acids are pointing in? And when you do that, things start to line up. So there's a complementary nucleotide, for example, that that they pair naturally through hydrogen bonding, which I know that's a scientific term, but it just means that they can two nucleotides of you know, different varieties can stick together, and holds this big macromolecule, this double helix, if you will, together. And now, you know, if you see structures of DNA, it looks like a spiraling.
Okay, well, was there any point in the experiment that they could actually see the shape of this thing, or is the shape derived mathematically from these X-ray refractions?
It's derived mathematically.
Ah, so has anybody yet today seen this double helix? Because now we have microscopes that can get down to the atomic level.
Right, electron microscopes can, I'm sure somebody has seen on a gross scale the, you know, the DNA. But if you take just DNA by itself, and it's typically has all kinds of proteins around it that normally protect the DNA, and what you'll see is just a big glob or a big long chain, for example. And DNA, the structure of DNA, I mean the base, that so Watson and Crick figured out the basic structure of the DNA, and then once they realized, for example, that it was that the nucleotides were pointing in instead of pointing out, they could then figure out that there's a code here. And so the actual genetic code was quickly determined by them to be You've got four different types of nucleotides, which then, if you're pairing those up, then leads to the genetic code, which makes up 64 different combinations. Now, not all 64 in each, let's say, it takes three of these nucleotides to define a amino acid and a protein. But when we only obviously have 20, 21 amino acids, different types of amino acids. So there were more codes, for example, than would code for the proteins. And then it was later determined that some of these codes are stop codes and some of these codes are start codes. And some kind of overlap with others.
This sounds awfully complicated. Is it just why you became a biochemist, so you could do this kind of work? I'm thinking these two guys.
Well, I was certainly interested in it at the time. And
Watson and Cricket, they would get up in the morning and they would shower and they would put on their lab coats and go to their place of work, and they would work with what, a blackboard and formulas? I mean, what? And I'm just interested in the physicality of their work. For example, they had theories about what this stuff was and how it looked like. How do we know at what point it became fact, accepted reality, as opposed to theory? Is it when the formula clicked? When the formula got solved on a blackboard, or whatever they were writing?
Well, they probably had models. You know, science by that time was making kind of stick models of things, and they probably made a stick model. Because if you draw it, it's only two-dimensional, but you could actually make a three-dimensional model of this. And so when they built it and saw that everything kind of lined up, then they took the measurements off the model, I would assume, and then used those measurements, plugged them into your equations that... basically Fourier transform, but we're not going to go into that. But it kind of reverses the process, if you will.
Okay.
And it's found out, from mathematically that, this structure actually does fit the X-ray diffraction pattern that we're seeing from these micrographs or from these photographs of the X-ray diffraction pattern. Now, interestingly enough, neither Watson or Crick took the X-rays and made the crystals. It was another person, Rosalind Franklin, and Maurice Wilkins, who showed the X-ray photographs to Watson, and that then stimulated them to figure out the structure. So there was multiple people involved, just as there were multiple people in the California lab working on this, and Crick was the chemist, the X-ray diffraction expert, and Watson was the biologist. So you had a biologist collaborating with a physical chemist, if you will, and that combination proved successful in determining the structure of DNA.
So today, 1953, the structure of DNA was unveiled. It was revealed, like, we've discovered this, and here it is. And the question that this is leading up to in my mind is, up until this time, how did evolutionists verify their conclusions regarding evolution? I mean, this seems to be a tool that will either prove it or disprove it.
And it's a tool that's been used to argue both sides, as we'll talk about in a minute. But up until this time, it was all kind of hypothesis. We've got, and it all came from the biology side, for example. We've got the We got this animal evolving into this animal just because they look similar and they might have similar functionality. So it was more morphological, more shape and function driven than it was actually chemistry or biochemistry to say that, oh, look, you know, the genome, for example, that word wasn't even known back then. The genome or the genetic information is the same between this animal or species, as they would say, or this other species, and so therefore they must be linked evolutionary, you know, from the evolutionary point of view. But it was interesting too, because when evolution was being discussed and popularized. Then by Charles Darwin, for example, the only thing that they knew about the cell was, okay, the cell has a cell wall, and there appears to be some type of nucleus, because we can see that under a microscope, but the rest of the stuff just looks like some thick soup. It doesn't have much structure to it, because they couldn't see any structure with the microscopes that they had back then. So they called it the cytoplasm, or it's kind of a soupy type of stuff that's got mixtures of different types of chemicals.
That's the word I learned in high school biology. Yeah, cytoplasm.
Yeah, well, it turns out that it's not soupy at all. As a matter of fact, the cytoplasm has a lot of structure in it, and molecules are actually, and proteins are actually transported from one place in the cell to another place of the cell, where they're actually used by very, very specific mechanisms, and nothing, it looks like hardly anything is left to chance.
They're like little factories, aren't they?
It's a very, very complex factory. Mm-hmm. That's what we're learning. And that's what, as we delve more and more into the structure of the cell, it's like, hey, the stuff goes in. The stuff that goes in gets transported to the place, where it needs to be used. It gets manufactured into something, usually a protein or some structural elements that the cell needs, and nothing is left to chance.
Okay, so evolutionists, people who were professing the evolutionary scheme of things, got a hold of this idea of DNA, and they employed it, and they found two organisms that had similar genomes, and they say, aha, they are related, or at least they came from a common source. That's got to be it.
That's right, the conclusion.
That's the conclusion we take issue with, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, because you see, if you look from a molecule up approach or a DNA up approach, and you find similarities between two organisms, then it's a logical conclusion that somehow these two organisms are related.
It is not illogical. I'll give it that.
Yeah, but if you take it from a top-down approach, and you say that everything was designed, of course you're going to find similar structures, and similar information in life here on Earth, for example. So that's two different a top-down or a bottom-up approach. Evolution takes the bottom-up approach.
Well, let's take a middle approach. And so these evolutionists, now with this DNA weapon in their hand, concluded that, and they would say those in the middle, that is, they weren't creationists and they weren't evolutionists, they were in the middle. They might say, aha, nature, something non-specific, found this design useful and productive, and therefore repeated it. Is there a middle position?
I really don't think so, because if you say nature, you're kind of saying, it happened by chance. I mean, nature doesn't by itself have any intelligence in it, and either this was designed or it was not designed, and it just happened by chance.
So design would need to come from an intellect.
Right, from a designer.
Hmm.
And a designer had to be outside the design, which is an interesting concept in itself.
Yes, it is.
But if you take the automobile, for example, because I think we can see similar design elements in an automobile. I mean, most automobiles have four wheels, for example, an engine, a transmission, brakes, and steering wheel, some mechanism to steer the car. And of course, there's
once you've driven one, you can probably drive any car. You would sit there, you would know what does what. No.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, an individual getting behind the wheel, it didn't matter which car that they would drive. They would pretty much know how to drive it. With the exception of the newer cars that you have to press a button and you have to put the shift in park before you can get the car started.
Mm-hmm.
Other than those newer, you know, technologies, everybody kind of knew how to drive a vehicle. But the point is that even though each of these cars, the different types of cars that we have, the different type of species of cars that we have, if you will, mm-hmm. Are all designed even by different people, you know,
mm-hmm.
but the basic design is the same. The functionality, the functional elements are the same.
Function determines form. Isn't that an old saying?
Right.
Something close to that.
So yeah. You would then say that, clearly this was designed, but notice where the designer is. He or she is not in the car making the car necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, putting the car together, obviously, but the design took place in nowadays in CAD, you know, laboratory or in you with the computer, mm-hmm. You know, kind of piecing everything together and making all of the shapes for the parts that are needed in order for the car to function. So the designer, if you will, is outside the platform that he's designing. And so it is with life. I mean, you know, with life, the designer has to be outside of life in order to be able to design it. So if you take the design approach, you've automatically say that, hey, who is this designer and where did the designer come from? And where is he now?
I'm pondering that. I love to consider that, because even when you think of concepts like time, the designer has to be outside of that, not subject to it.
Exactly. So hence, when the first verse in Genesis, I mean, why is the first verse so important, for the Christian or for those who believe that the Bible is indeed more literal than just a group of nice stories, is that it says, in the beginning, God, Elohim, mm-hmm. created the heavens and the earth. So, in the beginning, you got to ask yourself, in the beginning of what? In the beginning of the earth, in the beginning of the heavens, in the beginning of what's, you know, man, but in the beginning of time. So when you realize that time is a function of this space that we live in, then that automatically points to a creator outside of time.
It does. That's just an awesome concept. Yeah. Yeah. And we were going to talk, too, about this comb jelly genome, kind of back to DNA here. This is a fascinating-looking critter. And for those of you listening, if you check the link that I put in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com, it'll take you to this article where you can see a picture of the comb jellyfish, I guess you would call it. How do you pronounce that? Chenophore? Chenophore. I mean, that's the category of animals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tenophores. Okay. Tenophorus.
The Tenophorus, okay. Okay.
Yeah. It's, you know, when you put two consonants together, it's kind of hard to, it's the C-T-E-N-O.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the C is probably silent, yeah, but I'm not 100% sure of that.
But this one has perplexed evolutionists because they're getting into the genome sequencing and finding confusion there. What do you know about this critter?
Well, it's a very, and actually, you know, they were thinking that, okay, this is simple. It's a jellyfish. It's got to be simple, right? So it's got to be kind of low on the evolutionary scale. So it should be related to other jellyfish. Not when you look at the DNA. When you look at the DNA, for example, it's got its own DNA. Matter of fact, most of the DNA is not even similar to anything on this planet.
You know, and I've got this is I want to make this statement right here now, because this is key. It looks like it kind of has characteristics of a jellyfish. I'm looking at the picture here, and yet when you really get down to it, it's not a jellyfish. Now I can look at a biped ambling through the woods that we might call a chimpanzee, and I could see a man doing the same thing, and I could say, aha, there's similarity here. They must be related, until you get into the details and you discover that there are basic fundamental differences between the two that suggest to you that there's not necessarily a relationship like that, that one does not spring from the other. Evolution has discovered that in a number of areas, including with this comb jellyfish, or however it's pronounced there, and yet they seem to hold intact their other assumptions about similar looking organisms and automatically figuring and classifying them so that they appear to be related. I mean, they're flaws at the beginning, at the root of this thing.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, if you just go from morphology or how the animal looks, you would say, oh, yeah, it's got to be a jellyfish, and oh, it's a pretty jellyfish because it's got bioluminescence, and oh, look, it can change colors. Oh, that's interesting, and so therefore, it must be similar to other bioluminescent animals, which are. Wait a minute, this is a little confusing because bioluminescent animals are higher up in the evolutionary scale, but yet the jellyfish is lower. So how come we've got this already from the morphology, we've got this dichotomy that this animal might be what we would call unique. And lo and behold, when you look at the DNA, like I said, 56% of the DNA doesn't even isn't similar to anything. So it's got its own proteins and its own structures that are creating this bioluminescence and this structure for this unique animal that we just happen to call comb jellyfish, because it looks like it's got a comb and it looks like it's a jellyfish, so we call it a comb jellyfish. But yet it doesn't appear genetically to be related to anything. And so what are we going to say about this? Well, from an evolutionary point of view, it's like, well, this is a evolutionary freak, and somehow it survived.
And so what the natural conclusion then is that it's not the system that's wrong. It's not the evolutionary thing, but this thing doesn't exist. We'll ignore it. You know, rather than admit that it pulls the pin on the basic assumptions of evolution, explain this thing?
Well, you got to keep it in the black box. In the black box means that everything must have evolved here on Earth. Nothing could have been designed, and everything had to come by chance. So this one would say that, oh, this is just, it's just unique, and yes, it's not related to anything, so it must have sprung up by itself, independent of everything else that was going on in the evolutionary process of molecules to man. So yeah, that's how we explain it. It's just unique. Now, it screams, of course, that, oh, if it's unique, it was uniquely designed, because it is a complex animal, after all. whether it's complex or simple, it's still more complex than what we could design today. And so it's a complex system, and therefore it had to be designed by a complex creator. And so this is just another example of God's wonderful creation, where he made things to function as they are perfectly from the very beginning. And it had no, this animal would say, I've got no predecessors, and I have no, I don't have any ancestors, and I just kind of showed up, at the scene, and here I am, and it doesn't look like I've changed. And so there's no evidence of evolution going on. And so it's an evolutionary stumbling block, in my mind, as opposed to it is a perfect example of God creating something and creating it to function exactly as he wanted it created. And there it is for our enjoyment and amazement to look at and to marvel and to say, hey, we can, this is a beautiful thing. It's another beautiful creature that God has designed, and it functions perfectly in the environment it was designed for.
And going back to the genome and this DNA discovery, without that, it would simply be another jellyfish.
It'd be a jellyfish. It'd be a bioluminescent jellyfish. Mm-hmm. So there would still be that little bit of confusion between a higher animal and a lower animal somehow getting together. But when indeed you delve into the inner workings of the organism, you find out that, sorry, it's not a mixture of a higher animal and a lower animal. It's just a unique animal all by itself.
And a beautiful one at that. As you will see, if you follow that link in the chat window there at brokenroadradio.com this morning. David, any last-minute thoughts before we wrap up here?
Well, I keep thinking about movie or that series of broadcasts that I saw on PBS last night. And, there is a connection here. Just a second.
Okay,
but it's not.
Give me a chance to work on this.
Yeah, but it's not DNA, and it's not but one of the things that you said, Don, about creating something but being outside of the creation, and and the programs that I watched had a lot to do with artifacts of former African kingdoms. And they were about the same time of the golden era, the maybe 5,000 BC to 500 to 1,000 AD, that period of time when, a whole bunch of stuff happened. And I kept looking at the ruins that they left behind and these great big, huge statues, statues of, 30 or 40 feet high, carved out of solid rock that had been quarried something like 6 miles away and then carried over or dragged over and the person who was doing the announcing said, well, that probably took them a long time to move that stuff. Well, yeah. I guess it took them a long time to move it over there. There's an understatement, but I keep thinking, how did they move the stuff over to where it was in order to, forget why, but why would, or how do they lift these things? How do they move this stuff over?
That's been the challenge for so many things in antiquity that we just can't figure it out, including some complex things that have been found, technologically advanced things for the time that have been found in the Mediterranean that came out of the Greek culture and elsewhere. There's just no explanation other than these people were far more advanced than we give them credit for.
Well, exactly. And that was the thing that I was thinking about, is that we've still got this thing upside down. That those were the smart folks. We're the ones that are getting dumber.
I think we're standing on their shoulders, and we should acknowledge that. And again, this notion that in order to design something, to make something, you have to be outside of it. You can't be a product of it and still design it. You have to be independent of it to create it. And if we leave listeners with nothing but that thought today, I think it will have been a worthwhile conversation here. Ponder that for a while. Don, thanks very much. Appreciate your time today. Donna, also a
member
of the board of Creation Moments, their website, creationmoments.com. You can link to them from our website at Broken Road Radio, and I suggest that you do. You'll discover a whole lot of scientific information that supports biblical creation, and it makes a whole lot of scientific sense. You got to take a look at it. And Don, we'll check with you next week, okay?
Okay, very good. We'll see you folks, and you have a great week.
You too.
Bye-bye. See you, Don.